Which is the reason for our song this morning, "It Dare to Be a Daniel." You commonly know this as Daniel in the Lion's Den, but I want to just title it "Remaining Firm in the Faith" because he's an example of that. Hebrews 11:1 defines faith as the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. Unfortunately, in the English language, we have just about destroyed the word hope. We've made it to the equivalent of wish. And because of that, there's often a great misunderstanding of this verse and what faith is. Some have described faith as an optimistic blind leap of faith off a cliff. That is not so. Faith is the conviction. I had the definition written out here for you, so I wanted you to be able to see it. Faith is a conviction of truth that brings about an assurance of an eventual outcome. Faith has, or hope, has a confidence in it. It's not just a wish. There is a confidence. This is defining the hope. In addition, it is not a blind leap. It is founded solidly in the evidence of the character and the ability of God to keep His promises. That's what the definition of Hebrews 11:1 is talking about. That is hope, and that is the evidence not seen. We don't see God, we just see all the evidence of Him in everything. But He's a spirit, and so we don't see Him physically. But we do know He keeps His promises. So faith is stepping forward in obedience to God with the full assurance that the outcome is in His hands and He will do what is eternally best for His own glory and for you. That's faith. Now there are many things that are going to occur in life that are going to test your faith. That should neither surprise nor frighten us. James 1, 2-4 even tells us to count it all joy when we encounter these various trials. Why? Because we know that the testing of our faith, he says, produces patience. And patience, let it have its perfect work, that you may be perfect, complete, lacking in nothing. As various situations arise in your life, your belief and trust in God is going to be challenged. That's the test of faith. Will you walk in obedience to what he says, according to his promises, trusting him that he is able to keep and do what he says? To do what's actually best for you. That's the test of faith. And as your faith is tested, you walk in a greater trust of God. You become a more mature believer with even a greater and more solid faith for whatever comes in the future. Now this morning we're going to be examining Daniel. And he is a solid example of this kind of faith. And while it's doubtful that your faith is going to be tested to the extreme that his was here in Daniel 6, I think we're all aware that our brothers and sisters in Christ around the world do have their faith tested to this degree. Their life is on the line. Many are martyred. I just saw a news report last week that in the first decade of this millennium, the rate of believers being martyred is about 1 every 5 minutes. About 10,000 a year is the current rate. So yes, this goes on. And though you will not be tested yet in the United States to this degree, it could come to that. Nations change rapidly at times. It's also true that your faith is going to be tested in some similar manner. Not to the extreme, maybe, but it will be tested. Will you believe God and hold fast to obeying Him or not? If you cannot stand in what is really relatively light affliction, what will you do when severe persecution arises? What would you do when it becomes extreme? Learn from Daniel's example this morning. Apply the lesson to your life so that you are becoming more mature in your faith, stronger in your trust of God, so that regardless of whatever comes, you will be able to follow that example and remain true. Now, before we begin our study of Daniel 6, we've got to deal with this fellow Darius the Mede. He's mentioned the last verse of chapter 5, which is actually sort of a transition to 6. Remember that he comes about at the end of the Babylonian Empire. The Medo-Persian army conquered Babylon the very night that Daniel interpreted the handwriting on the wall. Belshazzar the king was slain, and then 531 says, Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. In Daniel 9:1, we also have a little more information on this man. It says, Darius was the son of Ahasuerus, of the lineage of the Medes, who was made king over the realm of the Chaldeans. Now, the specific identity of this man is somewhat uncertain. The ancient records are lacking, and what has survived sometimes is confusing. Various names and terms are interchanged, sometimes without a very clear understanding of who it's actually referencing, and so it becomes uncertain. The ancient languages themselves are somewhat uncertain, and because of that uncertainty, liberal scholars have continued to scoff at this Darius the Mede. They actually use this as one of the reasons why they say that Daniel was written in the second century. They say that whoever this imposter was that wrote simply made a historical mistake, and this is a fellow named Darius Hystaspes, otherwise known as Darius the First, who became king over the Persian Empire. But that's not, he's not even born until 522 BC. That's 17 years later than when Babylon falls, and this Darius the Mede is made king over the Chaldean area. So, well, frankly, I put it this way. It should be a stretch, even for those that hold to a second century date, that this kind of mistake was made. For one thing, it's very unlikely that an imposter would have made that kind of grave historical error and then put how old he was when he took it. He wouldn't have done that. He wouldn't have put in his father. He wouldn't have made that kind of detailed information. And second, the Jews of the Maccabean period, which would be about the 2nd century B.C., they would have known Babylonian Persian history well enough to have known the error, and they would not have accepted this as scripture to be included in the canon. But they did. So even those who falsely, wrongly hold to a 2nd century date of Daniel should not have gotten this one messed up. Now, there are several good possibilities about who this is. The first is that it is definitely not Darius Hystaspes. He lived later. He had a different father. He had a different ethnic origin. So it's definitely not that guy. There are a couple more reasonable possibilities. The first is that it could possibly be simply another name for Cyrus I. He was the king over the Medo-Persian Empire. He is the one under whom Babylon was conquered. But there are some problems with that. In favor of it is the fact that in Daniel 9, or later in Daniel 6, rather, where there was a word that's translated and, could be translated as even, which makes the two people being referenced just one person. That's a possibility. In Bel and the Dragon, and in some translations of Daniel, it actually lists Cyrus instead of Darius the Mede. So those are possibilities. However, Cyrus is of Persian descent, not Median descent, and his father is Cambyses the First, not Ahasuerus. That would have to be explained. What is most reasonable is this is a fellow named Gubaru. If my name was Gubaru, I think I'd prefer to be called Darius. Gubaru. Now, Gubaru is mentioned in what in a stele that's called the Nabonidus Chronicles. There was some confusion over this because in the first translation of that, there was a fellow named Ugbaru. Not Ugbaru and Gubaru. And both of them were end up having translated that they were a fellow named Gobrias. You're following me, right? Ugbaru and Gubaru both end up having their names translated as Gobrias. That made things confusing. More research in this has definitely shown that they are two different people. Ugbaru is actually the leader of the army that conquered Babylon under Cyrus. Cyrus had gone north. His army diverted the river. Ugbaru led the army into Babylon itself. Ugbaru became the governor over the area of Gudium. Gubaru became the governor of the area over the Chaldeans, or Babylon. Okay? See all that? Got that straight? Okay. Glad you got it straight. All right? Now, that he is called a king is really not that big a deal. We've seen already in Daniel 5, the term king was used for lesser authorities, someone over a province, and not necessarily the supreme king over the whole empire. That was true of Belshazzar. Now that we know who we're talking about, let's find out what he does. Daniel chapter 6, verse 1. It seemed good to Darius to appoint 120 satraps over the kingdom, and that he should be in charge of the whole kingdom, and over them three commissioners, of whom Daniel was one, that these satraps might be accountable to them, and that the king might not suffer loss. Then this Daniel began distinguishing himself among the commissioners and satraps, because he possessed an extraordinary spirit, and the king planned to appoint him over the entire kingdom. Okay? Now, we're not told how long after the fall of Babylon this occurred. It would not have been that long. And it was not uncommon for officials in one kingdom who were then conquered to become officials in the conquering kingdom. It's a pragmatic thing. They already know who everybody is. They know how the land is laid out. They know what can be produced. And as long as they will switch their loyalty, which is often common in minor officials, their loyalty is to whoever is above them. They switch their loyalty, they'll be fine. And that's what was going on here. So in order to take care of this province, he's got 120 people managing different areas. Over them, three commissioners or chiefs, Daniel being one of them, who held these 120 accountable. The king then only has to deal with him. But as he gets to know these people, it doesn't take long for him to see that Daniel is extraordinary in spirit. He is a faithful man, he's trustworthy, he does what he needs to do. And so the king is looking at, I'll just appoint Daniel over all of it, and I can relax. Kings can do that. All right? Especially if you've got a guy that's that capable. Well, that sets up some jealousy. It became obvious that he was far superior. Daniel 6, verse 4. Then the commissioners, the satraps, began trying to find a ground of accusation against Daniel in regard to government affairs. But they could find no ground of accusation or evidence of corruption, inasmuch as he was faithful. No negligence or corruption was found in him. Then these men said, "We shall not find any ground of accusation against this Daniel unless we find it against him with regard to the law of his God." So they formed a conspiracy. They've got to find some way to get rid of Daniel. They don't want him in authority over him. Now, we're not told the specific reasons, and there's a lot of possibilities. It could be simple jealousy. It could be an ethnic prejudice. We're going to find later they specifically point him out as being Jewish, and they don't want a Jewish man, especially someone who's taken captive, is over them. We actually saw that earlier in Daniel. It could be that they have a lot of corruption themselves, and if Daniel's dishonest, he's going to discover their corruption, they're in trouble. So they may be trying to prevent that. But whatever their reasons, they began by examining all the details of work, but they can't find any problems. There's no errors, there's no corruption. If only we had bureaucrats in our various levels of government of the same nature. There's no problem. There's nothing they can find on him, and I can guarantee you they turned over every stone they could. Now remember, Daniel now is in his mid-80s. He has a long history behind him. They can't find anything. And since he's faithful, they come up with another plan. They'd have to find something in regard to his faithfulness in keeping the law of God. But they run into another problem. They can't find any direct conflict. His keeping the law of God doesn't conflict in any way with him carrying out his duties. They have to create something. They plotted to change the law in order to create a conflict. Verse 6. Then these commissioners and satraps came by agreement to the king and spoke to him as follows. King Darius, live forever! All the commissioners of the kingdom, the prefects and the satraps, the high officials, the governors, have consulted together that the king should establish a statute and enforce an injunction that anyone who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days shall be cast into the lion's den. Now, O king, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it may not be changed according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which may not be revoked. Therefore, King Darius signed the document, that is, the injunction. So they set out to manipulate the king, and they are successful. They wanted to find a way to get Daniel in trouble, and they have got it. They changed the law. Now, Darius was easily swayed by their fawning over him. Now, the greeting of, "O King Darius, live forever," is simply, or was simply, the common court greeting. There's nothing spectacular in that. But they also come with a lot of flattery, a lot of things to boost his pride. Remember in Proverbs 29:5, it says that a man who flatters his neighbor spreads a net for his feet. And Darius was ensnared. First, they come in a large group. Now, they come under the pretense that everyone in the government, from governors all the way down to the captains, they had all agreed about what was going to be requested. Now, that's a lie. Daniel was not part of this at all. He wasn't even consulted about it. Daniel had not agreed. But let's face it, with evil people, truth is a little concern to them. Second, they manipulate the king's ego, attributing to him a godlike position, as well as their loyalty. Now, this idea of no petitions except to Darius isn't so much that they're saying that Darius is a god, although there is a play on that. It was not uncommon for the Persian kings to take on godlike attributes or have those attributes attributed to them. And so for a lower king to have people come and give the same kind of deference to him, that builds up your ego pretty fast. I must be something else. Look what they want to do for me. But it's not so much that they believe that he is a god that's going to answer their prayers. It's more that everything has to be basically done in his name. We pray to you, O God, in the name of Darius. All the petitions need to be gone through him. That's what's behind this. So he basically becomes the supreme mediator for 30 days. Again, that's quite enticing to pride. Plus, in doing this, it is a pledge of their loyalty to Darius of having such supremacy. That's good for his ego. At least it's good. If inflating, it's good. It's actually bad for his ego because it did overinflate it. Well, he gives in to his sinful pride. He takes the bait. He signs the decree, and it appears they came with it all written out to begin with. All he had to do was sign it, and now it's the law of the land. Now, notice that twice it in here it makes the point that a law of the Medes and the Persians is absolute. It cannot be changed. This is a step down from the authority Nebuchadnezzar had. He did whatever he wanted, any whim he wanted. Now, Darius is under the law. He's not over the law. He's under it. So once the law is made, he must keep it. The penalty for making a petition to any god or any other man other than Darius is going to be severe, being thrown into a den of lions. Now, envy and jealousy are common sinful ailments of mankind, so are ethnic prejudice, so is desire to keep one's corruption hidden. And these lead to all sorts of sin, including trying to find an accusation against the righteous. That's nothing new. It was old then, it's still around today. The unrighteous look for a way to make accusation against the righteous so they can benefit, giving greater freedom to their pursuit of evil while pushing the righteous away. Jesus even warned us that evil people such as this will make up things. They will lie. They will say all manner of evil against you falsely for his sake. A missionary letter I read last night, he thought he had made a lot of inroads into a province he was working in. He went up there last week and found out, no, the local religious leaders have put all sorts of slander out about him. He says, well, I guess it's going to be a while longer before I can get back in there and do some work. Lying, slander, that's common. We should understand that. Jesus warned us. Evil men continue to do such things. They will produce similar schemes. They have done so in our own time. There are plenty in our own society that call what is evil good and what is good evil. We are aware of that. They have worked hard to change our laws to match their perverted sense of morality. Over the years, many laws have been added to books that are designed specifically to punish those who practice the law while freeing up those who practice lawlessness according to God's law. One of the major latest ones, of course, is this marriage change. Now understand, all that has done is change the legal definition of marriage to include homosexuals. Since God is the one that instituted marriage, He is the one that's defined it. Only God can really change what marriage actually is. Our legal system may redefine it, but all it's done is just add perversion in. They haven't changed marriage. They've only said, we're perverted people. Okay, understand that. And when some couple that's of the same sex comes and say that they're married, you say, well, you're simply perverted. And you need Christ. Because currently you're going to hell. And I care enough about you to tell you, repent before it's too late. Now, this law was promoted as a civil rights bill. Understand, it is not a civil rights bill. Civil rights have never had anything to do with it. It is an attempt to change society's moral code and promote what God says is an abomination. That was its purpose. In addition to that, it is written in a way to punish those who disagree, who understand that God says it's a perversion. So both are there. The civil rights of religious conservatives will be violated in our state as they have in other states. If you have a business that in some way would have a couple of this sordid sense come to you to use your services, catering, photography, limousine service, any of those kinds of things, and you say, no, I cannot do this, it is against what God says, you are subject to a lawsuit. In other states, people have already been subject to fines and have lost their businesses because of it. Your children, and it's already on the books, to have the books changed, will be taught that this is a normal way of life. And your religious convictions about it have no say at all in it anymore. If they're in public school, they will be taught this. Scheduled to be starting in 2012. And they will be taught under what the advocates of it say. So understand, this has all been about perverting our society and punishing those who do right. Speaking out against in public will subject you to public ridicule, boycotts. It could even cost you your job. That's simply reality. How will you respond to it? What will you do, especially if you have something that you do that may be directly affected by it? What will you do? I talked to a man on Friday. He actually came to promote some kind of rally that's going to be up at the Bardavon tonight. It was a little strange. I thought it was about, well, it said, I don't have it. It's called The Ring Makes a Difference. Cardin Dolan's going to be up there and a couple others. It's going to be a forum, a panel on marriage. And I'm glad they're doing it. But they were writing in their local newspaper and they've been excoriated in the newspapers because they're promoting traditional marriage. It's one man, one woman. I've been writing the Southern Dutchess News for some time, though lately I find that they won't publish my letters. I don't know why. They haven't responded to my letter about that one either. But I've gotten a lot of flack when I will put things in there as, no, God defines marriage as one man, one woman, period. What will you do? What will you say? What about among your friends? What about your co-workers? How do we respond to those things? And understand, we can expect our representatives are going to continue these kinds of sinful actions. We can expect laws will get worse. Why? Because a sinful people are electing them because they want to be able to practice their sin without hindrance. So don't expect it to get better. Not until the hearts of the people are changed, which is why you want to change in government? Give out the gospel. Because when the people's hearts are changed, the government changes. So the first line of political influence is tell someone about Christ. Okay? There's where our politics begin. What will you do as the laws get worse? Daniel is the model for us to follow. This is one reason I wanted to preach through the book of Daniel. This is what we are to be doing now, the same as was done then. How did Daniel respond? Look at verse 10. Now when Daniel knew that the document was signed, he entered his house. Now in his roof chamber he had windows open toward Jerusalem, and he continued kneeling on his knees 3 times a day, praying and giving thanks before his God as he had been doing previously. Then these men came by agreement and found Daniel making petition and supplication before his God. Now, Daniel was aware that the new law had been passed. He was aware of the consequences of violating that law. But Daniel didn't vary a thing. He could have tried to comply by not praying at all during the 30 days. I just won't pray to anybody. That way I won't offend God. Actually, you will offend God doing that. And I won't offend the government. He could have tried to hide what he was doing by changing his prayer practices. Let's say only really early in the morning and really late at night so they weren't aware. He could have at least closed the windows. Daniel doesn't change a thing. He chooses to remain faithful to the practices he had always followed. Among these were instructions given is Jeremiah 29. The prophet there commanded that those in captivity, which Daniel was, were to call upon the Lord and pray to him with the promise that God would listen to them. And we know Daniel knew that chapter because in chapter 9, he references reading it, which is why he breaks into a prayer in chapter 9. It all is based on Jeremiah 29. So he's simply following the injunction that is given to him by the prophet. The custom of praying toward Jerusalem, it was simply the custom that got adopted at the dedication of Solomon's temple. And those who were away from Jerusalem were doing that. They would turn towards Jerusalem, where the temple was, and pray toward that. Praying at the morning, at evening, at noon, he was simply following the example of David. That's exactly what David says in Psalm 55. Now think about it. Daniel is a high official. He is a busy man, and yet he has taken time throughout his whole life to make sure he was in good communication with God. So three times a day, he'd make his way back to where he lived. Kneeling, he would pray. Morning, noon, and evening. The kingdom's business can wait. I got to go pray. And interesting, when they were looking for any kind of conflict or failure in Daniel, that didn't cause any kind of conflict or failure on his part, did it? I can guarantee you it only enhanced his ability in what he was doing. He simply continued regular communication with God. The law changes, I'm not changing what I'm doing. I'm going to remain faithful to God. His position of kneeling, that's simply an act of his own humility before God and keeping with the example given in Psalm 95, verse 6. So Daniel's actions described here are not done in any way in an obstinate manner. There is no sense on his part he's seeking martyrdom. He's not being antagonistic. Those things could be true if he had changed his practices to become more obvious. He didn't. He simply continued to do what he had always been doing, regardless that there was a change in the civil laws. I will remain true to following God and praying to Him. We need to learn to walk with the Lord in holiness and then not change from that, regardless of what sinful things are practiced in our society, what perverse laws are passed that make it more difficult to walk in holiness, or persecution that arises because of it. That's the example. These evil men were aware of Daniel's faithfulness to his God. And so after the law is passed, they send those over who will watch to find out when he does what they know he's going to do. He does, and they think they've got him. Daniel broke the king's new command, and they finally had a basis for accusing him. Verse 12. Then they approached and spoke before the king about the king's injunction. Did you not sign an injunction that any man who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days, is to be cast in the lion's den? The king answered and said, the statement is true, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which may not be revoked. Then they answered and spoke before the king, Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or to the injunction which you have signed, but keeps making his petition three times a day. Then as soon as the king heard this statement, he was deeply distressed and set his mind on delivering Daniel. And even until sunset, he kept exerting himself to rescue him. Then these men came by agreement to the king and said to the king, recognize, O king, that it is a law of the Medes and Persians that no injunction or statute which the king establishes may be changed. Now, it's very doubtful that all 120 satraps with the two commissioners came before the king to make the accusation. It's doubtful that most of the satraps even understood what the petition was all about, why the law was changed. They just got pulled into it. More likely, the conspiracy's leaders are the ones doing this, and they come before Darius and inquire about the law he signed and repeat what it is. When Darius confirms the law, then they accuse Daniel of both ignoring the king, i.e. it's a personal thing, as well as the law. They make no reference to Daniel's governmental position, was extremely high, but they do specifically point out Daniel's ethnic heritage as a Jewish exile. It's an effort to be derogatory toward him. Darius finally recognizes he had been caught in a trap. He had signed a very foolish law. For the rest of the day, the king tried to find a way to rescue Daniel from the penalty of the new law, but to no avail. It had been changed. At evening, they pressed the issue. The law of the Medes and Persians could not be changed, and also required that after an accusation was made, that justice had to be carried out by the setting of the sun. Darius had no other option. Verse 16. Then the king gave orders, and Daniel was brought in and cast into the lion's den. The king spoke and said to Daniel, "Your God, whom you constantly serve, will himself deliver you." And a stone was brought and laid over the mouth of the den. The king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the signet rings of his nobles, so that nothing might be changed in regard to Daniel. Now, Darius' reaction to all this is fascinating when it's remembered that he would not have known Daniel very long. And yet, he had already developed this kind of deep loyalty to Daniel. Even more remarkable was his understanding of Daniel's faith and Daniel's God. Now, he gave the order to have Daniel cast in the lion's den. And yet, he also expressed his own confidence, his own optimism, that the God of Daniel would deliver him. Now, notice how he phrased it. The God whom you serve. For him, this service means that God owes him something. You've been so faithful in this, your God will certainly deliver you. He did not understand that Daniel's God is the sovereign God. He simply had this as, you've been so faithful to him, he's going to certainly rescue you from this. That is a pagan mindset. Now, we don't know the exact physical layout of this lion's den, but we have uncovered other lion's dens in the area, so we have an idea of what it may have looked like. They tended to be pits in the ground. And around the pit, there would be a 4 to 5 foot wall erected around it to keep people from stumbling into it, which is a good thing. I don't want to be walking late at night and stumble into a den of lions. There was in the pit, there would be a partition with a gate in it that allowed the lions to be moved back and forth so the lion keepers can go in and clean the cages where they have to do. At one area, there was a opening in the wall with some sort of a door. In this case, it seems like it must have come up from the pit to a kind of a mouth opening, and a stone could be laid across it. Either it was laid across or rolled in front of it. There was a way to get in and out with the lions and lion's keepers. So that's where Daniel's put. He's put in the lion's den. There's some kind of opening up so you can hear what's going on. There's a place to seal the entrance into the pit, into the lion's den, and then they seal it with wax emblems. Now, that's the sealing. They would pour wax across the crack between the stone and whatever it's laying across, and then with their signet rings, they would impress into the wax. But notice who puts their signet rings into it. It's not just the king. It's the king and his nobles. Why? They don't trust each other. The king does not trust the nobles. They may just find a way to go ahead and go in and make sure Daniel's dead. If the lions don't do the job, they will. And the nobles don't trust the king. The king may just go in and rescue Daniel out, period. He'd been trying all day, right? That's why it's sealed. Daniel is left to whatever happens in the lion's den. That's the beginning of the evening, and he's in there all night long. When are lions most active? That's right. They're most active at night. Here's Daniel 6:18, the king's response. The king went off to his palace, spent the night fasting, and no entertainment was brought before him, and sleep fled from him. Entertainment and eating would have been a normal part of a king's life, but this night he'd have none of it. Instead, Darius spent the night fasting and without sleep. Again, the stress here is how important Daniel really was to him. Verse 19. The night ends, it's getting toward dawn. The king arose with the dawn at the break of day and went in haste to the lion's den. And when he had come near the den to Daniel, he cried out with a troubled voice. And the king spoke and said to Daniel, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you constantly serve, been able to deliver you from the lions? Now, as soon as it was light, so the king hurries over to the lion's den. He wants to find out what happens. The stone, again, does not have to be removed for him to be able to talk with Daniel. You can hear what's going on in there. If he calls out and Daniel answers, Daniel's alive. He calls out in a troubled, a lamentable, a sad voice. Why? Because he's uncertain of the outcome. He had been optimistic that Daniel would be rescued because, again, his mindset, Daniel served him a lot, that God should rescue him, but he doesn't know this God. Would God do it? The king's question places the emphasis on God, not Daniel. The God whom you serve, has your God been able to rescue you? That's interesting how he phrases it, because he knows it's completely in the hands of God. Daniel can't do anything about it. Darius even recognizes the Lord here as the living God, and that expresses a greater understanding of Daniel's God than we might otherwise expect. I think we can safely assume that Daniel had talked to the king about God and how he differed from the pagan gods. The king's desire was to know, had God, Daniel's God, the one whom he served, been able to deliver him from the lion's den? Verse 21. Then Daniel spoke to the king, O king, live forever! My God has sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths. They have not harmed me, inasmuch as I was found innocent before him, and also toward you, O king, I have committed no crime. Then the king was very pleased and gave orders for Daniel to be taken up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no injury whatever was found on him because he had trusted in his God. I'm sure that Daniel's voice was very pleasant to the king's ears. And Daniel gave Darius the customary salutation. He then explained God's intervention. The Lord had sent his angel and had shut the mouths of lions. They had caused him no harm because Daniel was innocent. Now that's an interesting thing as well. He says, King, I have committed no crime. Was the law changed? Yeah, actually the law was changed. Had Daniel committed a crime? No. Who sets the law? God sets the law. He sets the law. Anything that man makes needs to be in conformity to it. When it's not in conformity to it, there is no crime in disobeying it. That'd be an interesting one on the tape if it gets out. I wonder who'll come knocking at my door. But we do the same thing. Our obedience is to God first and foremost. Anything that's contradictory to what God commands, we must not obey. We must obey God. Period. And then willingly accept the consequences. No indication here of Daniel arguing or fighting. He willingly goes into the lion's den. We accept the consequences. We leave our future in God's hands. So at the king's command, Daniel is taken up out of the lion's den. He's examined, and indeed, there is no injury, no harm is found on him. He had remained firm in his faith in all circumstances. Darius now had plans for Daniel's accusers. Verse 24. Then the king gave orders, and they brought those men who had maliciously accused Daniel, and they cast them, their children, their wives, into the lion's den. And they had not reached the bottom of the den before the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. Now Darius understands he can't trust these officials, and he carries out a just retribution. Deuteronomy 19, 16 through 21 gives the Mosaic law the just punishment for those who make accusations. And the just punishment is that they are to be punished with the same punishment they were seeking for the person they were accusing. And that's what Darius carries out. In this case, they are to be cast in the den of lions. Now, admittedly, to our Western sensitivities, this idea of the entire family being thrown in seems harsh. It was a common practice of the ancient world. For one thing, it removed the possibility that some relative would later try and take out revenge against the king. There have been times when God has also carried out such punishment to that extent. Korah's rebellion is an example when Korah and his family stood on one side and Moses said, "If I am with the Lord, then something new will have to happen." And the earth opened up and swallowed them. They went down to Sheol alive. Not just Korah, but his whole family as well. Now, this would not have been all the officials that had come to the king in verse 7. These are going to be those ringleaders that had made the accusations. And the fact that those cast in are overpowered by the lions before they reach the bottom of the cave demonstrates the nature of these lions. These aren't circus lions. These are ferocious lions who are extremely hungry. That magnifies the miracle of keeping Daniel alive the night before, their mouths shut, and no harm at all with him. Then Darius the king wrote to all the peoples, nations, and men of every language who are living in all the land, "May your peace abound. I make a decree that in all the dominion of my kingdom, men are to fear and tremble before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God and enduring forever, and his kingdom is the one which will not be destroyed. His dominion will be forever. He delivers and rescues and performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on earth. Who has delivered Daniel from the power of the lions?" Now Darius makes a decree. It's very similar to Nebuchadnezzar's decree in declaring God's attributes and actions. I find it interesting how much he says about God's character. Again, it demonstrates Daniel had told him a lot about the true God, and now he believes it. This decree is written to everyone as a proclamation of what God had done in rescuing Daniel from the lions, but it also includes a command for those that are within his realm. There is something they're going to be required to do. He can't require it of those who are outside his kingdom. He can only proclaim to them, this is what God did. But for those in his kingdom, they were to give reverence, that's the fear and the trembling, to the God of Daniel because of his attributes and activities. He recognized the God of Daniel as distinguished from the pantheon of pagan gods that the Medo-Persians had worshipped. He is the living God, he is the eternal God, he has eternal kingdom, and that kingdom cannot be destroyed. Very different than anything the Persian gods could do. He also recognized that this God intervenes in the affairs of men to deliver, rescue, and perform signs and wonders, even as he had done with Daniel. So he understood even more than what he had said here. The chapter concludes with a short note about what happened to Daniel afterward. So this Daniel enjoyed success in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. The remainder of Daniel's life, he continued to successfully serve the kings of the Medo-Persian Empire, as he had to the Babylonian Empire, which they had conquered. The ability to be firm in faith is not something that suddenly arises in a moment. The testing is not what makes you firm in your faith. It arises from a faithfulness in walking with God on a daily basis. That's where it comes from. Those that consistently strive to live in holiness and practice righteousness simply continue to do those things regardless of the circumstances that come up. Whatever testing comes up, whatever persecution, they just continue on. I'm still going to live for God. I'm going to do the things I've always done. And then it suddenly seems like some great thing. It's not. They're simply doing the things they've always been doing. They're walking with God. Those that will yield to temptation and the pressure of the world when tested in minor things will more than likely yield when the testing gets severe. Will you be able to stand firm in your faith like Daniel did? Or how about Hananiah, Azariah, or Mishael? You will if you are striving now to live faithfully in the relatively minor testings that come up against you. If you are standing firm in those things, you will stand firm when testing becomes severe. There's no doubt in my mind about that. But if you're struggling now, then you need to improve your walk. Improving your walk improves your faith and trust and improves your firmness in it. Well, how do you do that? Well, get involved with other Christians. That's what the church is for. We are to help one another with our gifts, encouraging, uplifting, comforting, challenging, whatever it takes, with all the gifts working together, to help you walk with Christ. So get involved more deeply. Get involved with some of the groups we have, the men's group or the ladies' group. There's a ladies' Bible study every other Tuesday night. There's another one every other Wednesday night. The men's group is just starting a new book. I know we bought some extra ones, right? So we were supposed to buy some extra ones. Okay. You looked at me like, what? So if you didn't sign up for the book, come anyways. We want to help you. And the goal is we want to walk faithfully with Christ and encourage each other toward that. Yes, sometimes you have to stand alone. More often we stand together, as is Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, right? That's how we walk in faith. And as we walk in faith now, you know, it doesn't matter what kind of perversions come out of Albany or Washington, D.C. We will simply stand firm in doing what we've always done in walking with Christ. And we will let God handle what the future will be, because we will trust Him for whatever it may be. Whether it's be deliverance, or as so many of our brothers and sisters in Christ in other places, it may be going to heaven.